All right, everybody, get ready, because today we are going deep into the world of oligopolies.
Oligopolies.
You might be getting ready for a big meeting, or maybe just brushing up on some econ, or hey, maybe you're just like me and can't resist a good deep dive.
Right.
Either way, you are in the right place, because today we're going to unlock the secrets behind some of the biggest industries out there.
Yeah, we're going to answer that question. What is an oligopoly?
Okay, so basically an oligopoly is a market where a small number of companies, they basically run the show.
They dominate the market.
Exactly. Now, think about the last time you went out and you bought tennis balls. You probably got them from one of just four companies: Penn, Wilson, Prince, or Dunlop Slazenger. So that's oligopoly in action right there.
It's really interesting because in oligopolies, those companies aren't just competing with each other.
Right.
Their fates are kind of tied together, right?
Yeah.
What they do affects each other.
Every decision they make, it's like a ripple effect.
It impacts everyone else's profits.
Yeah, so it's like they're all playing this high-stakes game of chess, constantly, looking over their shoulder, trying to anticipate each other's move.
Anticipating each other's moves.
But instead of pawns and knights, they're moving around factories and price tags.
Yeah, and to understand that game a little better, that strategic dance, we need to talk about game theory,
Game theory.
which gives us this framework for understanding these situations where the players, in this case, huge companies, have to make decisions while also thinking about what the other players are going to do.
It's like a constant back and forth, right?
Yeah, it's all about navigating that tension between cooperation and self-interest.
Okay, so in theory, let's go back to those four tennis ball companies.
Okay.
They could cooperate, right? They could be like, hey, you know what? Let's just act like one giant monopoly. We control the prices and we all maximize our profits.
Like, we control the world's supply of tennis balls.
Exactly.
In fact, our source material gives a great example of how this would work. Imagine a town with only two water suppliers. Okay.
We'll call them Jack and Jill.
Jack and Jill.
Now, if they get together and they say, hey, let's limit how much water we sell so that we can drive up the price, we can act just like a regular monopoly. And in this example, the demand schedule shows that they would maximize their profits by selling 60 gallons of water
Okay.
at $60 per gallon.
Wow, that's a lot for water.
Yeah, that's a big markup. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
While the monopoly outcome is the most rational, if they were, thinking as one, often it's pretty unstable.
Okay, so why wouldn't they just join forces and, get rich together? Why wouldn't that work out?
Well, because, each of them is always thinking, well, what if I cheat?
Yeah.
So let's say Jack and Jill agree to each produce 30 gallons.
Okay.
Jack might be thinking in the back of his mind, well, what if I make 40 gallons?
Sneakily.
Yeah, so then I can undercut Jill and get a bigger part of the market.
And I'm sure Jill's thinking the same thing
Of course she is.
about Jack.
So they're both, even though they'd be better off if they just stuck to the plan, they're both tempted to kind of go rogue a little bit.
Right. And that brings us to a key concept in game theory, the Nash equilibrium.
Okay.
Now, this is the point where no one can improve their own situation by themselves.
By themselves,
Yeah,
yeah.
like they can't make a move that'll make them better off.
Got it.
So, in the case of our water suppliers, they're going to end up producing 40 gallons each because each of them is assuming that the other one is going to cheat.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy of distrust. And while this might seem like just a small town water fight,
Right.
this plays out on a global scale with real consequences.
Give me an example.
OPEC, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries,
OPEC.
they control a big chunk of the global oil supply, and they often try to cooperate to keep those prices high.
Okay.
But just like Jack and Jill, each member of OPEC is tempted to produce a little bit more.
To get more money.
Yeah, to get a bigger share of the profits.
So even with something as essential as oil, the thing that fuels our world, there is this constant tension between trying to work together and just wanting to get ahead.
And that tension is a defining feature of oligopolies.
It's like they have this potential to team up and be this big, profit-making machine, but in reality, it's way more messy.
Yeah, much more complicated.
Yeah, that urge to cheat, that distrust, it just makes it really hard to maintain that cooperation.
Right.
Okay, so now I think we're ready to move on to one of the most famous examples of this,
Oh, yeah.
the prisoner's dilemma.
The prisoner's dilemma.
But before we get into that, we're going to take a quick break.
All right.
So we'll be right back to dive into the world of strategic decision making.
Can't wait. Okay, so we've seen how that desire to kind of like get more can really mess up cooperation, even when everybody would be better off working together. To really get this, let's look at a classic example, the prisoner's dilemma.
Okay, this one always kind of like makes my head spin, but I'm ready to.
All right, picture this. Bonnie and Clyde, notorious bank robbers. They've been caught. The police, they got the smoking gun, but they don't have any hard evidence that actually links them to the robbery.
Oh, so they're in a tight spot.
They're in a tough spot.
Yeah.
Now the police, they come to each of them separately
Okay.
and they offer them a deal.
Okay.
They can stay silent,
Uh-huh.
and if they both stay silent, they both just serve a light sentence, just a year each for the gun charge.
That sounds like the best option, you know, if they're sticking to their ride or die code.
You'd think, right?
Yeah.
But here's where it gets tricky.
Okay.
If one of them betrays the other, if one of them confesses to the robbery, the snitch goes free, and the
Wow.
other one gets a 20-year sentence.
Oh, so now they're facing a real dilemma.
Yeah, they got to think carefully about this. And to make it even more interesting, if they both confess, because each of them is thinking, oh, the other one's going to rat me out,
Yeah.
then they both get 8 years.
Okay, so what's the smartest move in this crazy game?
Well, let's look at it from, let's say, Bonnie's perspective.
Okay.
If she thinks that Clyde is going to stay silent,
Yeah.
her best move is to confess.
Obviously.
Right? Because then she gets to walk free.
Freedom over loyalty.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the thing. Even if she thinks Clyde is going to confess,
Yeah.
she's still better off confessing herself.
Really?
Yeah, because she'll get 8 years instead of risking those 20 years.
Oh, wow.
So confessing becomes what we call the dominant strategy.
So no matter what Clyde does, Bonnie's best bet is to throw him under the bus.
It seems that way, right?
That seems cold.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the same logic applies to Clyde.
Oh, so they both end up
Yeah.
kind of screwing each other over.
They both end up confessing and they each get 8 years.
Even though they could have gotten away with a much lighter sentence.
If they had just trusted each other, yeah.
I could never be a criminal mastermind.
Why?
I would always like assume the best in people and think that they're going to be loyal.
I see.
That's not a good strategy in this game.
It's less about, blind trust and more about like the logic of the situation.
Okay, so how does this relate back to what we were talking about with oligopolies?
It's a really good way of understanding why cooperation can be so hard, even when it makes sense for everybody. Remember Jack and Jill, our water sellers?
Yeah, Jack and Jill.
Their situation is basically the prisoner's dilemma.
Oh, yeah.
Even if they make this agreement to limit production, each of them is tempted to produce a little bit more.
Like Bonnie and Clyde confessing.
Yeah, exactly. And instead of ending up with shorter sentences, they end up with less profit.
It's like they're shooting themselves in the foot.
It's a self-inflicted wound.
Yeah.
And this dynamic, it's not just these hypothetical water sellers.
Right.
Think about the Cold War arms race.
Oh, yeah, between the U.S. and the Soviet Union.
Both sides felt like they had to keep building up their weapons
Yeah.
because they were so afraid of falling behind and being vulnerable.
So if they do it, we got to do it too.
And that fear led to this huge arms race, which made the world a much more dangerous place,
Wow.
even though, ultimately neither side really wanted that outcome.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's a pretty chilling example of how this can play out with, really big consequences.
So if it's so easy for cooperation to fall apart,
Yeah.
like, is there any hope for oligopolies to like actually work together, or are we just stuck in this cycle of distrust in everyone for themselves?
Well, it's not always a disaster.
Yep.
Real world cartels, even with these temptations, sometimes they do manage to,
Work together.
work together.
But how do they overcome that urge to cheat? What's their secret?
One thing that really helps is if they know they're going to be interacting over and over again.
Okay, so like Jack and Jill with their water, they know that they're gonna have to like keep selling to the same people.
Exactly. They can set up like penalties for breaking the
So
agreement.
it's like, okay, if you produce too much this week, then I'm gonna flood the market next week, and then we're both gonna lose.
Yeah, it's kind of like a.
Like a mutually assured destruction thing.
Right, exactly. And over time,
Yeah.
they build up a reputation for being trustworthy.
Right.
And that makes cooperation the smarter choice in the long run.
Oh.
Think about it like a long-term relationship.
Yeah.
you're more likely to cooperate with someone if you know you're going to have to keep dealing with them.
Right.
And there's actually some really interesting research that backs this up.
Okay.
Have you heard of the Prisoner's Dilemma Tournament?
I feel like you're about to tell me about it.
I am.
Okay.
So a political scientist named Robert Axelrod, he held this tournament where people would submit computer programs.
Okay.
And these programs would play repeated rounds of the Prisoner's Dilemma.
Oh, interesting.
The goal was to see, like, which program could get the least amount of jail time over lots and lots of rounds.
So they're basically simulating those repeated interactions.
Exactly. And the program that won, it was based on a really simple strategy called tit for tat.
Tit for tat. That sounds like a playground thing.
It sounds simple,
yeah,
but it was surprisingly effective.
Okay.
So basically how it works is you cooperate on the very first move.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, you just do whatever your opponent did on the previous move.
Oh, so if they cooperate.
They cooperate, they cheat.
You cheat right back at them.
Okay, so it's basically like a strategy of, like, you know, reward the good behavior, punish the bad behavior.
Exactly. Yeah, it's reciprocity.
Kind of like parenting.
Yeah, yeah. Like parent.
Reward the good, punish the bad.
And what was really interesting was this tit for tat strategy. It beat all these much more complex algorithms.
Wow.
Yeah, it shows how powerful this idea of reciprocity is. Even in a situation where it seems like it's every man for himself.
Right.
You can still build trust and cooperation.
So even though this Prisoner's Dilemma thing kind of makes it seem like humans are, like, naturally going to screw each other over.
Yeah.
There's still hope for us to, like, figure out how to work together and avoid those self-inflicted wounds.
Yeah, there's hope.
Okay, but what about when those temptations to cheat are just too strong?
Yeah.
And cooperation breaks down? Do governments ever, like, step in to try and make things more fair?
That's where antitrust laws come in.
Antitrust laws.
Governments have a really important role to play here.
Yeah.
They have to try and prevent these oligopolies from getting too comfortable and using their power to hurt consumers.
Like having a referee.
Yeah.
To make sure everyone's, you know, following the rule.
Exactly. A really key law in the U.S. is the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Okay.
Passed back in 1890. Yeah. This was a big deal because it made it a crime to collude to restrain trade.
So no more backroom deals to, like, fix prices or decide who gets what part of the market.
Yeah, and this law, it's actually been used to punish companies.
Oh, really?
Remember that phone call between the presidents of American Airlines and Braniff Airways?
The one where they're like, hey, let's both just raise our prices so we can both make more money.
That one, yeah. It was a pretty blatant attempt to fix prices.
Oh.
And they got into big trouble with the Justice Department.
So antitrust laws, They're important.
They're crucial, yeah.
For protecting us from the bad side of oligopolies.
Yeah, but of course, things are never that simple, are they?
You're telling me there's some gray areas?
There are always gray areas.
Oh.
Because not every action that seems anti-competitive is actually bad for consumers.
Okay.
Sometimes what looks like collusion might actually be good for the market.
So then where do we draw the line? Like, when does cooperation become a bad thing? And when is it just, you know, good business?
That is the million-dollar question. It's something economists and legal experts, they argue about this all the time.
I bet.
Let's look at some of those gray areas just to see how tricky it can get.
Okay, give me an example.
Okay, one practice that's pretty controversial is resale price maintenance.
Okay.
Imagine a company, let's call them Super-duper Electronics.
Super-duper Electronics.
And they make these really amazing streaming media players that everybody wants.
Oh, I think I know the ones you're talking about.
They're good, right?
Yeah, they're on my wish list.
So let's say they sell these players to retail stores for $50.
Okay.
But they tell the stores, you have to charge at least $75 to customers.
So they're controlling the price even after they've already sold the product.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, at first, it seems like, well, that's not fair.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't those stores be able to compete and maybe offer me a better deal?
Right.
But some economists, they argue that this can actually help consumers over time.
Really? How does that work?
Well, think about it this way. Super duper. They might want to make sure that all of their retailers are providing a certain level of service.
Okay.
You know, knowledgeable salespeople.
Yeah.
Nice showrooms where you can try out the gadgets.
All right.
Maybe even free tech support.
Like those fancy electronic stores.
Exactly.
Where they, like, treat you really well.
And without this resale price maintenance, Some stores might just undercut everybody else on price.
Yeah.
Offer no service at all.
And then rely on the other stores to like do all the hard work.
To educate customers, yeah.
Yeah.
So resale price maintenance, it's a way to make sure that all retailers invest in that service.
Which is good for the customers, ultimately.
Yeah, it benefits everybody in the end.
Okay, so it's not as clear cut as it seems.
No, not at all. That's just one example.
Okay.
Another one that's really interesting is predatory pricing.
Predatory pricing. Okay, that sounds a little more like, you know, like villainous.
Yeah.
Like, what's that about?
Imagine an airline. Okay. Let's call them Coyote Air.
Coyote Air.
Now, Coyote Air, they have a monopoly on a certain route.
Good.
And then a new, smaller competitor comes along.
Right.
We'll call them Roadrunner Express.
Roadrunner Express.
Roadrunner. They're trying to shake things up a little bit.
Yeah, the little guy taking on the big guy.
Exactly. And now, how does Coyote Air respond?
Uh-oh.
They slash their prices.
Oh, that's got to hurt.
Like way down, maybe even below cost.
Below cost.
Yeah.
Wow.
So the big question is, are they doing this to drive Roadrunner out of business so they can then raise prices again and go back to being a monopoly?
That's ruthless.
It is ruthless, but economists, they don't all agree on whether this is even a good strategy in the real world.
Okay.
Because think about it. If Coyote Air is selling tickets below cost,
yeah,
they're losing money.
On every single passenger.
Yeah, and the lower the price,
the more people they attract,
the more money they lose.
Okay.
Meanwhile, Roadrunner Express, they can just kind of scale back, wait it out.
Right.
Right.
Hope that Coyote Air runs out of money first.
So the predator ends up being the one that gets hurt.
Sometimes. Yeah. So it's really tricky to say whether this is a real threat or just something that sounds scary.
So antitrust law is, it's tricky.
Yeah.
It's like, you got to be really careful.
It's like walking a tightrope.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out like what's okay and what's not okay.
Right. And then you've got like the digital economy, which like changes everything.
Oh, yeah.
And all these like giant tech companies.
It's a whole new world.
Yeah.
It brings up a lot of questions about, you know, whether those old rules still make sense.
Yeah.
Because those old rules were designed for a different time.
For those old like industrial era companies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not for these new tech giants.
It's like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole.
And the stakes are high.
Yeah.
Because if we make the wrong moves, we could, you know, stifle innovation and limit what consumers have access to.
Right. But if we do nothing,
then we risk letting one company just get too big.
Too powerful.
Yeah. And that could hurt everybody.
Yeah. So it's a balancing act.
Yeah.
We have to find a way to promote competition while also letting these companies, you know, innovate and do cool things.
It's a tough job.
It's not easy.
Yeah.
And it requires like a deep understanding of how this digital economy works.
Right.
And a willingness to change our rules, right, to adapt to this, you know, ever-changing landscape.
Right. So I think we can all agree that we've just scratched the surface of this whole oligopoly thing.
Absolutely.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave our listeners with a question.
Oh, good.
So we talked about how governments are trying to like regulate these companies, but what about us?
Consumers.
What about consumers? What role do we play in shaping the market?
That's a great question.
Can we, like through our choices, can we influence how these companies behave?
Yeah.
Like Amazon, for example.
I think we can, but it requires us to be aware of these dynamics if we understand what's going on.
Yeah.
Maybe we can make better choices about where we shop, what we buy.
Yeah.
What kind of future we want to create.
Some things to think about.
Some things to think about.
All right. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
We'll see you next time.
Until then, keep those brains buzzing.
Yeah. It's amazing to think about how Amazon started out as just an online bookstore.
Right.
And now it's like everywhere. Like they do everything.
They really do. It really makes you think about, you know, how the government should be dealing with these huge companies in the digital age.
Yeah, like those old rules, the ones meant for like the old school monopolies.
Yeah, yeah.
They might not work so well for these new tech giants.
Yeah, that's the big question, you know. How do we take those old ideas about like market share and anti-competitive behavior and apply them to Amazon?
Yeah.
Because they're in so many different businesses and the way they do things is always changing.
It's tough to keep up.
It is, and the stakes are high. We get it wrong, we could end up stifling innovation.
Right.
Or limiting choices for consumers.
But if we just like sit back and do nothing, then we risk letting them get way too powerful.
And that could hurt everyone, competitors and consumers.
So it's a delicate balance.
It really is.
Trying to like encourage competition.
Right.
But also let companies like Amazon, you know, keep doing their thing and coming up with new stuff.
Yeah, finding that balance, it takes a real understanding of how this digital world works.
Yeah.
And a willingness to like adapt our rules as things change.
Well said. So I think it's safe to say that we've only just begun to explore this whole oligopoly thing.
Yeah, we've just scratched the surface.
We've gone from like the basics of game theory to like real world examples like OPEC and the Cold War.
Right. And then to this whole debate about Amazon and the future of antitrust law.
And through it all, we keep coming back to the prisoner's dilemma.
It's such a powerful concept.
Yeah. It shows how like even when it makes sense to cooperate, people, you know, they're often tempted to just look out for themselves.
And that can have some pretty big consequences.
Absolutely. So even though it can seem kind of bleak.
Yeah.
There's still, you know, there's still hope that we can figure out how to work together.
I think so, too.
Avoid those pitfalls of like distrust and self-interest.
Right. Because in the end, finding ways to cooperate, that's what's going to lead to the best outcomes for everybody.
Couldn't agree more. Well, that's about all the time we have for today. But I want to thank you all for joining us on this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure.
And remember, knowledge is power. The more we understand these complex issues, the better equipped we are to make informed decisions and shape the world we want to live in.
Absolutely. So keep those brains buzzing, folks, and we'll see you on our next deep dive.